Next case on the calendar is A220673.
Just a minute, Madam Marshall. I think we're waiting for some other attorneys to arrive.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I'm wondering if the Brian who is on here is Brian Bankstead, but maybe he's not arguing. Okay, thank you. We had some issues with our first hearing. People had the wrong Zoom link. I don't know if you also had that issue, Mr. Hockenden.
No, Your Honor.
Good.
I can.
Okay, thank you. Madam Marshall, would you please call the case?
The next case is A220673, Shawnee Feltis, respondent, versus Jeffrey Nimala et al. Appellants and Remax Thousand Lakes, respondent.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're holding this hearing by Zoom and we can hear both of you. If at any time there are any glitches and technical glitches and you can't hear us, just raise your hand and we'll stop the clock, okay? And with that, you'll each have 15 minutes. Please state your name at the beginning of your argument and the client or the party that you are representing. Mr. Ringsfred, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may.
May please the court. My name is Miles Ringsred. I represent appellant Jeffrey and Linda Nimala. This has really been a particularly frustrating matter for me because at every turn it is really smacked of bad faith. And when I speak of respondents at this point, I'm going to be referring to Ms. Feltis as Remax really at this point hasn't had been too involved in this matter. But respondents' arguments can really be boiled down into two issues. First, it's the purchase price, and second, involves the septic system. And I intend to be brief because appellant's brief has really addressed these issues better than I can do in the time I have today. But I'm going to try to focus the conversation into each one of these areas. So please jump in whenever you have any questions, as that's what I'm here to do today. To adopt respondent's argument as it relates to the purchase price and which the court or district court adopted, you first have to abandon basic contract principles and then completely disregard the entire purpose of what a contract for deed functions as a seller financing document. Respondent really even went to such an extreme length to establish this position that when pressed on this topic during depositions, after a short break with her, when she consulted her attorney, she returned and stated that she didn't even know what interest was. So the respondent's argument went that because the purchase price was stated at a certain amount, that is all that they were required to pay. And because she had paid over that, they are entitled to restitution for anything that went over that purchase price. Obviously, this is problematic for a number of reasons. First, it's a seller financing document. If this position was adopted, every contract for deed in the state would, every purchaser would be able to just disregard the payment provision and just say, you know what, I've overpaid because the purchase price says this. The district court and respondent's argument just completely ignores the plain language in the payment provision, which establishes how the payments are to be made.
Counsel, let's talk about that language. Is it your position that the language is unambiguous or ambiguous? And I'm talking about paragraph 4 of the purchase agreement that has the purchase price language, which states that purchaser shall pay to seller the sum of $49,000, and as for the purchase price, for the property payable as follows, 83 payments for $750, which I think equals the 83 payments times 750 equals $62,250. So is it your view that that language is ambiguous or unambiguous?
It's my position that it is unambiguous. At this point, it's very, it depends on a couple of things in my mind. It's the question really came down to, does the contract for deed, does it require that interests be stated in that payment provision, is essentially where that boils down to in my mind.
What is your reading of it? How do you read it as being unambiguous? What do you read it to say unambiguously? Because I think you will agree that the purchase price sum of $49,000 is not the same as the 83 payments of $750. Those two numbers are different numbers. So I'm trying to understand how there isn't an ambiguity there given the difference in those two numbers.
Because the purchase price provision in any contract for deed is going to differ from the payment provision, whether it says it is stated interests or not. It's the whole point, unless the purchaser came with cash on hand, this is being financed. And so it is just the same as any contract for deed payment provision, except for it doesn't specifically state an interest amount.
Right. So you agree there's no statement as to interest. So how can it be unambiguous then as to when what payment satisfies the contract for deed?
Because the payments that satisfy it are the payment provision. That's the provision of the contract for deed that states how they are going to complete the transaction. And so I do not see really how it is ambiguous.
And but with no statement regarding interest, how is it clear that payment of one or the other is not sufficient to satisfy the contract of deed? How is it clear that it has to be the full 83 payments of $750, which I think is your position, right?
Yes. Because again, I think if you just go to, I have seen nothing that requires interest to be explicitly stated in this payment provision. And I think to hold otherwise would prevent other types of things happening. I guess if you, I don't know any law that would prevent a purchase of this property for $49,000 and then finding some other medium. The payment provision could be in the equivalent value of bushels of grain or whatever they would want to bargain for. So I just don't see anything. I have not seen anything that requires an interest rate be specifically stated in a contract for deed.
Well, the customary way of I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just have one more question related.
Sure, go ahead.
So why even include the $49,000 language if the requirement to satisfy the contract for deed is the payment of 83 payments at $750?
Because this is a seller financed document. That's the purpose of a contract for deed. Every contract for deed and every sale of a property says how much it's, what the value of it is. If you're going to come up with $49,000 and pay it, then there's no point in having really, it would just say payment of that. Whereas in this instance, they just need to pay according to the payment provision. There's always going to be a difference between the payment provision amount and the purchase price of the contract. That's how they list the property. Whether it's going to be a contract for deed or whether the purchaser is going to go to a bank to get the cash to pay that off immediately.
My question is, it's customary to use the word interest. I'm not super familiar with a terribly large number of contracts for deed, but they usually say purchase price is $49,000 payable with interest at the rate of something from and after some date and monthly payments of some number. I mean, that's how it generally appears. Would you agree?
I would, Your Honor. And that that sort of gets us into the area of parole evidence. So if anyone did take the position that this was this is ambiguous, if the 49,000 figure and the difference of the in the payment provision creates an ambiguity, then we would start looking at parole evidence, which is where really the Ophoven contract for deed comes in. The REMAX hired the law firm to create a contract for deed based on all of the a fairly extensive record of documents. It went from a lease, purchase agreement, lease to buy with an option, and to this. And that contract for deed very specifically did state that in terms of interest at what percent and how paid. However, that also included balloon payments and a down payment, which respondent was not able to assume and did not want to have to deal with. And so, if we're looking at an ambiguity here, all of the documents support the position that interest is applied. I mean, it's really inherent in the document itself.
Counsel, we're here on summary judgment, correct?
Yes.
So if there's an ambiguity, wouldn't the appropriate result be to remand for an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing or for the parties to submit evidence regarding extrinsic evidence regarding the ambiguity?
That is that happened as part of, at least the extrinsic evidence was submitted part of the motions for summary judgment. I believe that there would be enough on the record. Yes, if there is an ambiguity.
But if it's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If there is an ambiguity, yes, that is a question of fact. However, if based on the evidence before the court, they can make a ruling on that. And other than going in and talking to, taking, I guess, testimony, which we somewhat did with depositions, in which, again, respondent literally said she didn't know what doesn't know what interest is. It's hard for her to say that interest did not apply to this. That is their actual position, that interest does not apply to this. And that's completely refuted by all of the parole evidence and the surrounding documents that led up to the creation of this issue. Are there any other questions, I guess, regarding the purchase price?
I don't think so. Why don't you move on to the septic?
Absolutely. And so, yeah, the second issue came down to the septic and the respondent's position that NEMLAs are solely responsible for its replacement. First, that is not true. There's an issue with whether there's an addendum to the contract for deed. That's an addendum that was created as part of the Ophoven contract, where the contract for deed that was executed did not check the box that said there would be an addendum. And so there has been some question about whether this was added later. However, without going into the weeds on that, the position that NEMLAs are solely responsible for the replacement is pretty much not true, because the addendum says that they would negotiate for the replacement of this of the septic system. And even further,
well, counsel, then isn't there a fact question as to that issue about responsibility?
Sure. That's also somewhat similar, because there's also what the SSTS compliance form, which was executed the same time as the contract for deed, in which the respondent, Ms. Feltus, took complete responsibility for the septic system. And so there are a lot of interesting issues of questions of fact where their position was, and the district court awarded them $15,000 based for the replacement of it, allegedly for the replacement of it. This was based only on two applications by respondent for a loan for $15,000. And this all kind of comes down to the Itasca County sending letters saying that they need, Ms. Feltus needed to get a, basically have someone come in and inspect and make sure that the septic system is in compliance. At this point, there is nothing on the record that shows that the septic system even needs to be replaced. There is zero, that they haven't gotten the someone to come in and inspect to see if the septic system is in or not in compliance. And if it was not in compliance, what it would actually cost to get it into compliance. And so the district court, at the behest of respondent, awarded $15,000 to replace something we don't know if it needs replacing and have no idea how. It certainly would not cost $15,000 to replace a new septic system. And at this point, there's just nothing on the record to support that. And somewhat to your point, Your Honor, the question about who's responsible and so forth, that certainly could be a question of fact that would be remanded. However, I do believe with the SSTS compliance form in which respondent took complete responsibility for it is very determinative in this area.
Thank you. I don't think there are any other questions in your time. You want to say something in the last 10 seconds?
I'll reserve my last 5 seconds for...
Okay. You'll have 5 minutes and 5 seconds then.
Thank you.
For rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Honkinen. I represent the respondents in this matter, plaintiff Shawnee Feltus. She actually happens to be here today. She's sitting next to me here, coming to say hi. So she's here.
Hi.
So this is my client. And so this morning, basically, this entire matter, if it were actually argued or pled as needing to impose a interest rate in the contract for deed, that hasn't been sufficiently pled, but more so is the fact as that the NEMAs don't even actually argue that there was a mistake in the contract, there was any ambiguity in the contract. And so their statements kind of belie their position. And so that's what we run into here, because it's like actually the defendants, appellants in this matter, want to have it both ways. They want to be able to say, well, it's unambiguous that the purchase price is $49,000, but really she has to pay $62,250. There just needs to be an interest rate. And so the court could have used, or the defendants in this matter could have asked the court to use its equitable powers to insert a interest rate into the contract for deed, and it didn't do that. They didn't ask for it.
Mr. Honkinen, let's get to what I think is the crux of the issue here, and Judge Cochran pressed Mr. Ringsred on it.
Sure.
It seems to me that there are factual issues with regard to both of the issues that have been raised on appeal. And if there are factual issues, then a judge shouldn't grant summary judgment. That's for a fact finder to determine. So tell me why I'm wrong in thinking that there are factual issues on both of these topics.
Because the defendant, Mr. Nimala himself, said that there's no mistake in the contract, that there's no ambiguity, and that the purchase price is $49,000. He alternatively said it was $62,250. When you run into self-serving statements and you just put out any kind of statement in order to get past summary judgment, merely having an averment like that is not enough to succeed. And so that's exactly...
In terms of whether there is an ambiguity, isn't that a legal question? That's not something, you know, that the defendant, we rely on the defendant's view of, correct?
Sure. And the court made its determination on that basis and said that the contract was unambiguous.
And we review that de novo, I believe.
That's correct.
So let's look at that language of paragraph 4, the purchase price. Can you explain why you think there is no ambiguity there and why, in your view, that it unambiguously only requires a payment of $49,000 when that language, the $49,000 language, is followed by language that the purchase price is payable in 83 payments of $750?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason why is because if you look later on in the contract for deed, you're going to find other indications or uses of a specified interest rate, of which there is none. And so, I mean, the issue, if you look later on in the contract, it talks about, and it would be paragraph 16 and 17, where it talks about protection of interests. And in the fourth line down, you'll see where it says, with interest at the rate stated in paragraph 4 as an additional amount due seller under this contract. And there was nobody disagrees with the fact that there was no interest rate. Okay. So then the question is that should the court be impugning an interest rate into this contract? And that is an equitable issue that I think changes the standard of review for this court, is because the appellant in this matter is not complaining that the district court abused its equitable powers. The appellant in this matter is complaining that the court stated that the purchase price was unambiguously $49,000. That has been the argument of the appellants in this matter, is that they're not arguing that the purchase price is $49,000. They're saying that the purchase price is $62,250, which is different. Like, a purchase price is different than a payment term. Those are two separate things. And so if the appellant in the matter was arguing then that the purchase price was $62,250, then the district court just has to choose which one of those two is actually the purchase price. And that's why you'll see
that. But why isn't that a fact issue? The district court doesn't decide at summary judgment which is the purchase price. That's a fact issue, isn't it?
No, it's not, with regard to whether or not it's an unambiguous term. Is the purchase price itself an unambiguous term of the contract? Yes or no? So is it $49,000 or 83 payments of $750? The court answers that question to state it's unambiguously $49,000. She says that's probably the most important term in a real estate purchase like this, is like, what is the cost or the price of the house? The other question with regard to the payment term, like how it's going to be paid, that can be whether or not it's ambiguous or not. But the fact of the matter is that the appellant's argument in this case has been that the purchase price has been $62,250. This was stated in the deposition by the defendant, Mr. Niebla. I can't change his testimony. He didn't argue that there was a mistake, or he didn't argue that there was an ambiguity. And so that's the issue that we run into here, is that what is being complained of wasn't actually factually asserted, to which the district court could actually rely on to say that, okay, there's a fact issue between, you know, credibility issue on what the purchase price was.
Counsel, assuming we agree with you that the contract unambiguously states that the purchase price is $49,000, where in the contract does it say that title shall pass once the purchaser pays $49,000 through payments of $750 for however many months that takes? I mean, that's basically what the district court found, right? That she had paid $49,000 making these payments, and therefore she was entitled to title of the property.
Correct.
And so and disregarded the 83 payments at $750
yep.
per month.
And so what was your question, Your Honor?
What language in the contract provides that the contract is satisfied once she pays $49,000 and that's it? Because that's basically what you're arguing, I think, that she isn't obligated to pay any more than $49,000 under the contract.
I believe that would be under paragraph 3, page 2, upon purchaser's full performance of this contract.
So, but then how do you give meaning to the language and as for the purchase price for the property payable as follows, 83 payments of $750 beginning on January 14th? Doesn't your reading render that language meaningless? With regard to satisfaction of the contract.
Not necessarily, because it's the amount that she did pay in order to not default. And she paid those amounts and never defaulted.
We're probably all asking sort of the same question different ways, but paragraph 4 is purchase price, and it's all one sentence, really. It does say $49,000 payable at 83 payments. And I did a little math here while you were presenting. It would be $750. It'd be 65 and a third payments of $750 would equal $49,000. So it seems like Judge Cochran was asking, you're asking us to just disregard one of the provisions of the purchase price definition. It's defined two different ways. It's defined as $49,000 payable as 83 payments of $750, which comes to a completely different number of $83,000 or something like that. I don't know. I can't remember. It's a 60-some thousand, I guess. But in any event, don't we have to give effect to all of the terms, at least all of the words in the one sentence that relates to purchase price?
The answer to your question is yes, except for the fact that the underlying facts of this, of what the defendant is asserting, is that there was no ambiguity and there was no mistake. And so
one party claims that it's unambiguously $49,000, and the other party claims it's unambiguously 83 payments of $750.
Correct.
But I'm not sure either of those things is unambiguous from the contract as written.
So, and I understand the argument here, except for the fact that this was where in the underlying case, what the district court was asked to do was to determine what is the purchase price. That's the question. Not how it's paid. It was like, what is the purchase price? So the purchase price was $49,000. The defendants in this matter agree with the fact that it was paid, that the purchase price is $49,000. They need, and by the way, they never paid or gave my client any kind of like interest statement for being able to, you know, count any kind of money for her, her taxes for a mortgage payment. And so she was never given that benefit. And so the defendants themselves don't even think that it's actually should be interest. Okay. They never treated it like interest. And so at the end of the day, the defendants themselves are simply trying to get the most amount of money that they can out of this. And so, and that's like the underlying issue of this. And so
everybody's motivated by their personal financial interests. We know that.
Sure. But it's also like, yeah. But then it's like you're filing taxes that say that you didn't collect any interest on anything. So then it's like, well, what do you go with? So it's like, if they're not treating it as interest and under a penalty of perjury to the IRS, then why should my client have to suffer doubly then? Because she never gets to have a interest rate deduction on her taxes. She's never given the opportunity to do that.
And what should we do about the septic system issue?
With regard to the septic system, the issue really comes down to the fact that the septic was known to already need to be replaced. And in my client's deposition, it was like it was known that there needed to be a mound system put in. Everybody that lives in this area up here, when you're having a transfer of property up here, it's a common issue to deal with the septic system.
Counsel, so, though, isn't there a fact question as to that? Because the letter from the county says that that a licensed professional must be contacted to determine whether the septic system is in compliance or not. So that determination hasn't, you know, it appears that there isn't any record evidence that that determination has been made.
That's true, only to the fact that everybody already knows that it needs to be replaced. It will, this, the transfer of this property can't happen with the current septic.
Well, the transfer, they either need a letter from a letter of compliance. Well, they need a letter of compliance, right?
From the seller, yes.
From a licensed septic inspector.
To state that it's in compliance. But if it's not, but at the end of the day, there needs to be some kind of letter of compliance. That's the ordinance that's in issue. And so, and that's why the district court found as it did, is that there's been no certification of compliance, because there can't be.
Well, is there any evidence in the record to demonstrate that someone with knowledge about septic systems has determined that it's not in compliance?
Well, my client testified that she is like, it needs a mound system because that's what it needs. That's common. But to the extent that there's been a certification or an inspection of the septic system, no, there isn't.
And is there any information as to if it does need to be replaced, what the actual cost of replacement would be?
Other than what she asked for on the $15,000, you would not see anything in the record, but I can tell you that the replacement of a septic system costs a lot more than $15,000.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Of course, Your Honor. Remember to add that 5 seconds. I don't need it. All right. Just quickly touch back on the whole payment provision. Yes, the payment provision of a contract for deed is the payment provision of a contract for deed, at least what the purchase price is. As Your Honor pointed out, it is the same sentence. Provision four is one sentence. It's $49,000 payable as this. So to read them without that, it's just basic contract principles. You can't just disregard some words in there. Then this.
So just to clarify, is it your position that the purchase price is $62,250 as respondent was arguing?
No.
Is it your position that it, sorry.
Sorry. No, the purchase price is very clearly $49,000, as it is on every contract for deed and sale document. That's what the purchase price would be if they paid it all up front. That's what the whole, again, a seller financing document, a financing instrument of this. That's the whole point. The seller is financing it's a time value of money. Rather than getting all that money up front, the seller is saying, if you paid me $49,000 right off the bat, we're good to go. But because they didn't and they're doing an installment, it's the time value of money.
It's your position then that there's no opportunity for early payoff. Even though the price is $49,000, the contract isn't satisfied until there have been 83 payments of $750. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And then when it comes to the court and Mr. Honkanen saying that the purchase price is the most important term in the, I mean, that's been brought up a number of times and it's never been substantiated with any authority. I mean, it's a purchase price number, but the terms of how you pay that are also just as important as that. And it just so happens that the 83 payments of 750 equals what the payment provision in the Ophoven contract for deed, which did give an interest rate, was. What essentially happened, and it was fairly clear from the record, is that they took the total amount that this purchase price with a certain interest rate would be, found out what that amount would be, and divided it by a figure that they would be able to pay on a monthly basis. And then that's what created the number of payments that would be needed to be made. And the fact that appellants or respondent was saying that appellant didn't treat this as interest is not true. There's at a certain point, if we had to, we can get the there's a standard interest rate that is applied to things like this. If his tax CPA needs to come in and say so, that can happen. And saying that there is no mistake or ambiguity is a question of law. And actually in the complaint, we cross-claim for reformation of the contract and in the alternative. People plead in the alternative all the times in cases like this. And so, and then I guess finally, or one more thing with the septic system, everyone doesn't know it needs to be replaced. No one knows it needs to be replaced at this point until a licensed professional says so or certifies that it needs to be, and then figure out how much it would cost, and then figure out who is responsible, whether it needs to be negotiated or not. But then
you've really gone on in your briefing. I don't think we've talked about this yet. You've gone on in your briefing to say that we should alternatively grant you summary judgment because the district court denied it, right?
I was just about to get to that.
You would agree that ordinarily, if we were to reverse and remand as you want us to do, ordinarily denial of a motion for summary judgment is not appealable, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What takes you outside of that ordinary rule?
Because right now, I mean, it's sort of at this point, it is. And the reason we're here is because I'm not sure how familiar you are with the briefing, but because this took a long time.
I'm pretty familiar.
Or having to go back to get here. We appealed a year before, and then we had to get the, this is essentially the close of this case. The REMAX claims are all very periphery at this point. And when it comes to the failure to pay insurance, that's really what got this whole thing started. The Nimuas were asking, as the contract required them to show proof that they were carrying.
I didn't ask you. I don't mean to ask you why you should have gotten summary judgment. What I mean to ask you is procedurally, why is the denial of your summary judgment motion appealable?
Because it's an error of law. I mean, at this point, if REMAX was not part of this case, this would be a final judgment, and that would just be an error of law. At this point, it is very clear, despite respondents' assertion otherwise, they have not shown that they made and maintained insurance throughout the term of this contract for deed. They said so and swore to it, but even in their own exhibits and so forth, they have not been able to show that.
And thank you very much for your arguments. You had more than 5 seconds beyond 5 minutes. So the case is submitted, and we will have our order out within, or opinion out within, the 90 days. Thank you very much. I think we're going to take a break now, right, Ms. Hino? Until 10 or 11:45. So we'll stand in recess.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.